Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 134th General Assembly convenes this week with the same issues at hand when the last session wrapped up before the holidays, COVID-19 and a bevy of unresolved measures, including the controversial nuclear bailout bill. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us today, Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmert. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And also Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hi, Happy New Year.
And Anna Staver, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Anna.
Hi.
All right, so the vaccine rollout nationwide has been slower than expected. I guess no big surprise. But where's the breakdown in the distribution process? What are they talking about when it comes to Ohio? Do any of you know?
Well, I know part of the challenge has been just getting it out to the people. And the other challenge has been, like, they haven't received the shipments on time in order to set them all up. The state has also talked about the holidays slowing things down, but I don't know how much of an valid excuse that is. Like, they knew these vaccines were coming and they could get rolling on it. So I think those are questions we're going to have for the Ohio Department of Health and the governor this week.
Right. I mean, yeah, the holidays we knew they were coming. And also the post-Thanksgiving surge, I think Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams mentioned that as well. Governor DeWine on CNN State of the Union with Jake Tapper on Sunday would not criticize the federal response. Does the federal government play much of a role in all of this when it comes down to distributing the vaccines?
I think they play a role in getting them to Ohio. Obviously, they're deciding how many are distributed to individual states and what parts get distributed. And then Ohio is deciding where they go from there. So a certain number of them are being distributed to hospitals to go to healthcare workers there. And then the pharmacies are largely taking, there are four different pharmacies that are taking care of distributing to nursing home populations. Now those nursing homes, I think something like 60% of them have gotten their first visits. But that doesn't mean people are being vaccinated at those locations. So it's kind of a two-step process. Obviously, the federal government has to get them to Ohio, and then Ohio has to get them out to the various people who need them in that first, like, 1A group.
Now, you know, nursing homes, that's become an issue. It's considered a frontline place in the battle against COVID-19. And New York Times reported last week, I believe, and Governor DeWine has, it comes from his estimates that more than half of nursing home residents have been vaccinated at this point, but that workers are rejecting the vaccine. And he estimated by about like somewhere around 60% of the workers in nursing homes are rejecting the vaccine. Does anybody know why at this point?
I don't think it's clear. And then the other challenge is Ohio isn't tracking the rate at which people are refusing these vaccines. So that 60% number has been tossed around, but we're not even sure if that's accurate. And I think this has been a challenge throughout the entire novel coronavirus pandemic, is what data do we have and how is it being distributed to people in a way that they can understand it? And even like nursing home deaths by facility are records that we've, you know, gone to court of claims over. So there's been a lack of data collection and like compilation throughout this entire pandemic. And so that's certainly coming up now.
The lack of data collection, that's a really good point, Jesse. Is that through the Department of Health? Is that a role they would be playing? And have they explained why they're not keeping data on this?
So I haven't specifically talked to the Ohio Department of Health about this. So I don't have a clear answer as to why they aren't. But a lot of the way this data is collected is like local health departments will collect the information and then ship it up to the Ohio Department of Health that pulls it all together. There are some things that are reported directly to the State Department of Health, but that's not a lot. And a challenge that has been ongoing for months is the network, the technology that they use to compile data is very, very old and really wasn't prepared for something like this. I mean, it
it echoes our state unemployment compensation system, which really wasn't prepared for this.
Good point. Yeah.
I mean, if you've ever used a very old computer and like tried to use a bunch of new functions on it, you know this, but it's happening on a statewide scale.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. I've been talking with Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Also with us, Jeremy Pelzer of the Cleveland.com and Anna Staber of the Columbus Dispatch. Okay, so last week, Governor DeWine extended the 10 p.m. curfew for three more weeks until January 23rd, I think. Jeremy, do they talk about any kind, or Anna or anybody, I mean, do they talk about any evidence that the curfew is playing a positive role?
I wasn't around for that press conference last week, so I don't know if he spoke to it at that point. In general, the governor has spoken about anecdotal evidence. He's saying there's a correlation. He's not saying if there's a causation. You know, it's really hard to tell. You can't say, well, we prevented X number of cases of coronavirus because of this 10 p.m. curfew. But he has noticed that, you know, cases have leveled off, and he's been careful to, you know, give the credit to the people of the state of Ohio for doing this instead of patting himself on the back necessarily.
Yeah. Anna Staber, it just seems like, I don't know.
I think, this is sort of my own thinking, is I think the idea is, I know he doesn't want to close down bars and restaurants to in-person dining again, or at least not yet. Like he seems as though he's hesitant to enact some stricter requirements. And the 10 p.m. seems to be, anecdotally, he's indicated that, you know, the hour gets late, you've been drinking. This is when you see bars where people start to intermix, where they start to get too close to one another, when they start to sort of let their guard down. And I think the logical thinking is, if you can cut it off before those things happen, you can perhaps prevent, like, send everybody home before they make, I don't want to say poor choices, but like, I think there's like a logic to it and a theory. But I think it's driven by this desire to not have to close in-person dining and that kind of thing again.
He has relaxed quarantine recommendations for students and teachers based on guidance from the Ohio School's COVID-19 evaluation team. Did any of you follow that? And do you know what they found? And
I think it's mostly in line with the easing of like the quarantine orders that the CDC even started, because, you know, originally it was you had to, if you had been in close contact, so within 6 feet for more than 15 minutes of someone who had tested positive for COVID, then you had to quarantine, like stay away from other people and isolate yourself for 14 days, whether or not you had symptoms. And that was causing challenges, especially in schools, because if one student had tested positive for COVID, maybe that takes out an entire class or an entire sports team or something like that, when a lot of people weren't exhibiting symptoms, or some portion of people weren't exhibiting symptoms. And so the CDC relaxed that to 10 days if you hadn't received a negative test, or 7 days if you had received a negative test. And I think the thinking from the CDC that Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff was mentioning was that, like, if these rules are less strict, people are more likely to comply with them. So I think it's kind of a moving towards better compliance with a more limited quarantine rather than kind of shoddy compliance with a 2-week quarantine.
Let's move on to the 134th General Assembly. It kicks off work this week. And they start with, you know, swearing in the new members, right? And I was wondering, is there anybody notable, anybody new in the Ohio General Assembly, anything, any big changes as far as the makeup of the bodies in the Senate and the House that is notable, do you think?
I would say the biggest change you have is the new Senate president is Matt Huffman. He's a Republican from Lima, and he's actually not going to be taking the oath of office this morning in person because he has coronavirus. That was just announced earlier this morning.
Okay.
Succeeds Larry Obhoff, a Medina Republican. So they agree on most things, but Matt Huffman has been a big proponent of school vouchers in particular. That's been one of his big issues. And he is definitely he can be very assertive at times, and can have a strong personality. And we'll have to see how he gets along with Bob Kupp, who's going to remain the Speaker of the House.
Who's also a Lima Republican.
That's right. Good point.
Yeah, that's right.
He's from Lima.
But one's an old, but Kupp is an old school Republican, and of course, Matt Huffman is new school, different, younger, different generations.
More of a Tea Party Republican, right. if that's still a thing.
Yeah, I think I don't know if Tea Party is still a thing, but I think it really does describe. It's a good description. All right, so he's got. I didn't know that. I didn't know that he had COVID-19. Is there any sense about how the General Assembly is going to approach safety when it comes to the coronavirus? Are they going to require masks or anything like that?
I would anticipate their response will be similar to last General Assembly.
Okay.
You're not, one difference from last GA to this GA is there are actually more Republicans in the House and one more Republican in the Senate. And so I don't think you're going to see a shift towards this Democratic approach of like mandating masks, which for better or perhaps more likely worse, this has become a partisan issue when it comes to wearing masks. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of change in that. The Senate has been good about like doing online like press conferences or like having people call into that. The House has been doing pretty much in-person everything. So you see a little bit of difference between the two chambers, but I think you'll see a similar approach to what they were doing last General Assembly when it comes to coronavirus. They do have policies in place about, you know, staying home if you're sick. A lot of the staff are working from home. They changed a few things about committees at the end of 2020, but yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of committees, those appointments have all been made.
I think they should be made soon.
Yeah. If with Senator Huffman off, I mean, Senate President Huffman off, is that going to change things, Jeremy?
Not really. I mean, even though he has coronavirus, it's apparently a pretty mild case. So it's not like he can't work from home like a lot of the rest of us are, too.
Okay. And as far as... you know, what do we know about what might be at the top of their agenda at this point? Any ideas, Anna Staver?
When I spoke with Huffman towards the end of the year and talked about next year and what he was looking towards, he appointed a Senator Bill Blessing, and that's sort of going to be the point person on education. So as we know, House Bill 305, which was the big, massive education reform bill, didn't make it across the finish line last year.
Mm-hmm.
And Huffman has said it's a priority to put it into the budget.
Okay.
And so Bill Blessing will be the guy in charge of that. And then obviously we have redistricting coming up. So next summer, that will be one of the big priorities that takes over the legislature, figuring out where all the lines go and who gets drawn into whose district, especially if we lose congressional seats, which we're supposed to.
Right.
One of the big questions that I think Jesse's been following is what, if anything, are we going to do on House Bill 6? So we had that court case that came down that delayed the fees. So First Energy won't be getting a little bit extra from everybody now. But what the legislature does next, that's kind of a big open question.
What, Jesse, speaking of those fees, what is the calculus? I mean, is that temporary?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was a preliminary injunction that the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas judge put in place, and then I believe the Ohio Supreme Court like gave kind of an okay or something like that to that. So he has delayed it for a few months. That gives lawmakers a few more months to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that will be interesting to me is with new lawmakers coming in, many of them Republicans, do they have a different approach to House Bill 6 than the former lawmakers, or are they just going to be kind of freshmen and go along with the policies that have been enacted by their predecessors? For example, there's a lawmaker from Claremont County down in Southwest Ohio who had a lot of dark money spent against him by the householders aligned dark money groups. And so he is obviously not a big fan of this policy and the repercussions of it. So if you have people like that, who maybe would be a voice against the status quo, but I think a lot of the dynamics are going to be similar to where we left them in 2020.
I want to talk about House Bill 6 some more when we return. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Jessie Ballmert. She is state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Also with us, Anna Staver of the Columbus Dispatch and Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and CNN's Jake Tapper shared a heated exchange over congressional Republicans opposed to certifying the Electoral College results.
We have a lot of people in this country who are very concerned about
because they've been lied to, Governor.
With the change in the-
Governor, because they've been lied to by President Trump for weeks.
Jake, time out a minute. Let's stay at the big picture. The big picture with changes in technology, potential hacking, all of these things, we need to have a commission, as Senator Portman says, that takes a long look at this, not something you can do in 10 days.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jessie Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and Anna Staver, statehouse reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. The governor already has tasted some of President Trump's wrath regarding this topic. Is that why he's going along with these conspiracy theories, falsely claiming election problems? I mean, is there been any issues in Ohio that he can point to necessarily, Jeremy Pelzer?
No issues in Ohio that he can point to, especially on a widespread scale, at least. This has been just vintage Mike DeWine, where he make sure to go after the problem. Like, he'll say, look, there's no evidence of election fraud, but then he doesn't go into the next step and say, well, President Trump is wrong to say this. So this is absolutely in keeping with what Governor DeWine has been saying, and I don't expect that he's going to change it. And DeWine is asked about this often, whether it's election fraud it's ever since DeWine took office, he's regularly been asked whether the president is wrong on certain issues. And, you know, he's consistently kind of done the I'm not saying, I'm just saying answer.
Yeah, except when it comes to he did finally acknowledge that Joe Biden is president-elect, but it took a while.
But also, he didn't say that President Trump was wrong to deny the election results. He just said Joe Biden is our president. So again, he's going after the issue and saying, here's what I think, without going after the president about it.
Jessie, how long? I mean, he also, by the way, I mean, his point is well taken, and something, a long commission, not just something you can do in 10 days. And it feels like something that could define the next 4 years if they go this route.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting how long this gets dragged out and how much of an issue it becomes for not just President Trump, but his supporters. My thought on DeWine's conversation is he's defending less the president and more those voters who support the president. And I think DeWine is looking at a potential Republican primary in 2022 against someone who would be running from the right. So either a Jim Renacci or a Jim Jordan or some other person we haven't thought of yet. And so I think he is cognizant of where he needs to be with those voters. And that might be why he's making statements like this.
Hmm. Can he, what are your thoughts at this point? It's, you know, I mean, now is the time to start talking about 2022, I guess. As far as a challenge from the right, Anna Staver, could he manage that with the Republican electorate such as it is in Ohio these days?
I think the big question is how many people get into the race. So if you have a Jim Renacci, a Jim Jordan, and perhaps somebody else, then I think DeWine is in a much better position than a head-to-head with one person who represents the right, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That, like, in a split ticket with multiple people in the primary, I think DeWine emerges because he's the familiar known name.
And you just have a simple majority, no matter how many contestants.
Head-to-head, I think it gets trickier. If the far right of the party unites around a Jim Jordan who has a national fundraising base, who has a very clear brand in support of the former president or soon to be former president, like, I mean, that could be a really tough ride for him. I think that's the biggest question for me. And, you know, feel free, you know, either Jeremy or Jesse to weigh in, but I think if it's a head to head with somebody like that, DeWine could be in trouble potentially.
Yeah. Jeremy.
I think that, DeWine is definitely the heavy favorite going into it. I think there's a very limited number of people who both have the credibility to launch a primary challenge to Governor DeWine on the right and have the wherewithal and the money and the name recognition to have a legitimate, credible campaign. I think the list right now kind of starts and ends with Jim Jordan. Jim Renacci, as you saw during his U.S. Senate run, didn't fare too well. He had fundraising problems. He went through several campaign managers. I think if Jim Jordan runs, you could see a natural credible threat. But other than him, I don't see any major candidates that could unseat DeWine, at least in the primary.
Just personality-wise, do you see Jim Jordan really wanting to give up that national loudspeaker that he has developed in Congress?
And that's the thing, like, the conventional wisdom is that Jim Jordan wants to be Speaker of the House one day. Not the Ohio House.
The big
DC.
One.
And so that's the conventional wisdom. But then, you know, he said he's open to looking into it, which certainly doesn't mean he's running. You know, everyone can say that they're open to it. But he hasn't ruled it out either. So we'll see. But yeah, I was even a little surprised when I heard that Jim Jordan was even open to it, because up until now, his focus has squarely been on federal politics and not on state politics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jesse?
Yeah, kind of tis the season for speculation, and we might end up with just one name on the Republican primary ballot by 2022. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a portion of the Republican electorate who is very frustrated with Mike DeWine, to say the least, about especially the closures and even just delaying, closing the polls on the primary. You saw some lawmakers from Southwest Ohio even trying to impeach the governor. So there is that sentiment among the Republican Party and the Republican base, and that's not going to go away. But is that enough to unseat someone who has, you know, good fundraising, amazing name recognition, and a history of politics in Ohio? We'll see.
Yeah, and, you know, and it is early. No matter what, a lot can happen between now and 2022. House Bill 6 could prove to be, problematic for lots of people going forward. Anna, State Rep Rick Carfagna, a Delaware County Republican, was talking about HB6 in a text. He referred to next level pressuring when it came to efforts to get him to support HB6. And thousands of documents like that were made public as part of an FBI public records request, public records release. What did you learn of note? And it wasn't the uniformity that many of us might have thought.
Well, I think a lot of what was in those records was kind of confirming some of the things that we knew at the time. So we knew that Carfagna was a no, but you never heard it like the thing about these text messages is that I think they were sent between people who didn't expect them to ever become public.
That's always the case, isn't it?
Yeah. And so they were more candid, more open when it's, so you get like two lawmakers talking with each other and about the pressure that they're feeling. And that's a really, it's a unique look into how they were feeling in that moment when they were just talking amongst themselves. And so, you know, Carfagna at one point says, like, I feel like I need to take a shower after I have one of these conversations. And so it just, it gives you the sense that he thought that there was something underhanded about it even back then. And I think there was a lot of, I wasn't here in Ohio when it passed, but I've talked with Jesse and I've talked with other reporters who said, like, yeah, there was this sentiment that like there was a lot of pressure back then. And it's just,
well, it's just that the Ohio General Assembly can't seem to get much of anything done. And the next thing you know, you've got the likes of House Bill 6, you know, flying through, you know, with, you talk about the skids being greased. It's was a standout for that reason alone.
Yeah, and I think that's what you see in the text messages. So he got, you know, so Carfagna got a call from U.S. Representative Steve Stivers. He got calls from high up within like the Trump administration and the RNC. He was getting calls from all kinds of people that you wouldn't expect to be lobbying on this bill who were involved in pushing him towards it. And then you had some pretty curt messages from Larry Householder. I am curious to see what they redacted, because even though they sent thousands of documents, there was several dozen that were either fully or partially redacted. So, you know, what we see from Householder saying, like, I just want you to know that you weren't there for me twice. Like, is that just the polite things that we are allowed to see, or is that everything? Like, we don't really know yet.
All right. So Larry Householder lost his role as Speaker of the Ohio House after the House Bill 6 allegations and investigation came to light. But he did not lose his seat. In fact, he won it, I think, with 70-something percent of the vote in his Perry County district. So what happens next in his career in the Ohio House? Does he get committee appointments? Are they going to keep him? What can they do with him? Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, he's going to be seated today as a duly elected member of the General Assembly. The reason he was elected, reelected with 70% of the vote is he was the only candidate to appear on the ballot because the Democrats didn't run anyone against him. And he was the nominee when he was arrested last July. So he's going to be seated. The question now is whether the House is going to expel him, as they previously said they might do. But it's an open question if they're going to do anything. Speaker Kupp told Ohio Public Radio a few days ago that, you know, maybe we'll look at doing something sometime next year. You know, so it's an open question whether they'll do anything. Certainly, he's not going to be elected Speaker of the House or have any leadership like that. The likelihood of that is very, very, very low. Before he was elected Speaker, Larry Householder didn't really serve on any committees. And it's an open question now whether he will get a committee assignments. And if so, I can't imagine they'll be very prominent. Of course, you have to note that if he is convicted of any crime, he's charged with racketeering conspiracy. If he's convicted of that under Ohio law, he automatically has to leave the Ohio House because no felons can serve in the Ohio House.
Right.
Yeah, I think there was a lot said before the election when lawmakers were not sure how the public was going to respond to this bribery investigation and to the House Bill 6 scandal in general. I mean, you had people, you know, then Speaker Kupp saying that they would consider removing Larry Householder. You had, you know, then Senate President Larry Obhoff saying we're going to rip out House Bill 6, we're going to rip it out. So there was a lot of strong language before the election. And then after the election, Republicans increased their control in both the House and the Senate. And in a lot of ways, the biggest repercussions from the House Bill 6 scandal were Larry Householder losing his gavel and Dave Greenspan, a Cleveland area Republican, losing his seat. So not large effects right now so far.
Thomas Suttis, columnist, They published his column in the Columbus Dispatch on Sundays. Made the point that Householder was among President Trump's first and strongest Ohio supporters. I'm quoting. He said there's at least a chance, agreed slight, that Trump could pardon Householder. Do you think that Larry Householder is on Donald Trump's radar? And I say that, I mean, given the point that you made earlier, Anna Staver, Rick Carfagna, Representative Carfagna, was hearing from people pretty high up in the Trump administration and among big GOP circles. So, thoughts?
Gosh, I don't know. I feel like, I mean, if we just hadn't lived through 2020, I'd say like little to no chance, but now I'm like going to be very cautious about hedging my bets on anything. I don't know. I believe you have to apply for a pardon. I don't think, so I don't know if that's something he's even considered. And a preemptive pardons, I'm not really familiar with how that law works, because obviously Householder's trial won't have even started before Trump is out of office. But I suppose it's within the realm of the possible, given that the president is pardoned a number of his personal associates, that he, if you look at his pardons, but I don't know. I guess it's something we'll be checking every day. It's up until January 20th to see if something like that were to happen.
The deadline looms. I mean, Jeremy, yeah.
The thing is, though, I don't think the president can even issue a pardon against Larry Householder because it's a state-level offense. My understanding is the president can only issue pardons for federal crimes. And this is not a, well, I mean, he is being accused of a federal crime. That is very true. So.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I mean, this is a federal crime. So he could, you never know with these things in the outgoing days of an administration. A lot of people you don't expect to get a pardon end up getting a pardon. And Larry Householder has done everything until his arrest, at least, to tie himself to the Trump train. And he was looking at running for governor in 2022 and was hoping to get the support of President Trump. And I think it's a possibility. I don't think it's, if I'm a betting man, I don't think I would bet on it though.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it was certainly reported at the time House Bill 6 was being passed, but there was such a flurry of activity that maybe there wasn't a lot of attention on the amount of pressure coming from members of Congress, Bob Poduchik, from the RNC, mm-hmm. and Donald Trump's Ohio campaign chairman was making calls on this. I mean, the governor was even interested in flying some lawmakers back to Columbus, and that ultimately didn't happen. So there was a lot of pressure even outside of Larry Householder to get this done.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, Anna Staver of The Dispatch, and Jesse Ballmert of The Cincinnati Inquirer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, and still with us, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Ballmert, Cleveland.com politics reporter, Jeremy Pelzer, and State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Anna Staver. The Governor DeWine had a couple of bills on his desk. One is the Stand Your Ground bill. What's his timetable for taking action on these things? What's going on, Anna Staver?
Well, I believe today is the deadline for taking action on Stand Your Ground. So we're all waiting to see today is basically the last day he can veto it. And he has said in the past that if the legislature sent him a bill like this before they sent him Strong Ohio, which was his gun control bill that came in response to the Dayton shooting. So he said if another gun bill like Stand Your Ground came before that one, that he would veto it because he wanted his his reforms first. And so what we're waiting to see now is whether he's going to keep that promise and he's going to veto it or not. And he seems to have taken until the very last day to decide. So, but because the legislature has already ended, so the 133rd General Assembly is over, I don't believe they can't override it. They can't go back and, you know, undo his veto, but they can reintroduce it. So they can start all over again with a new Stand Your Ground bill. So I think we're all just like hitting refresh on our inboxes, waiting to see if we get a notice about what he's done.
Anybody want to speculate? Jesse?
He is not going to sign it. So the alternatives are he is going to veto it or let it take effect without a signature. I think the more likely scenario is he vetoes it for all of the reasons that Anna enumerated there. And you even had some Republicans in the Ohio Senate voting against this bill for various reasons. You had a kind of impassioned speech from Senator Pigulaner, who is no longer in the General Assembly, but represented the Dayton area, saying that that symbolism is important, that we can symbolize that we're moving in a direction of peace and kind of addressing the larger issues of Ohio, where we can symbolize that like guns are the most important thing to Ohio lawmakers. You had another senator who was, Senator John Eklund, who was concerned about kind of the legal premises and challenges of this proposal. It's a proposal that is opposed by the largest city's police chiefs, by Ohio prosecutors. So I think, though it is obviously challenging for Republicans to oppose Second Amendment bills, I think there are ways that you could find a kind of Republican argument for vetoing this, especially when he said repeatedly that he wanted something else. So it'll be interesting.
Huh. And, you know, Jeremy, if you want to add to that, of course, but I'm also wondering if he does veto it, does that do him any good when it comes to his Strong Ohio package that I suppose is still out there?
I think the likelihood of a Strong Ohio package passing, even in this new General Assembly, especially when there's even more Republicans than last General Assembly, I don't think it's going to make much difference whether he vetoes this or not. I don't think right now it looks like he doesn't have a whole lot of support for it in general. What Anna and Jesse are saying is absolutely correct. You know, what do they say? Take people at their word for what they're saying. And everything that Mike DeWine is saying is, I would rather you pass my other gun reform proposals before this, and you're not. So he's given a lot of indications that he's going to veto it, and he hasn't given many indications at all that he's going to sign it.
There's another bill county fair organizers are upset about. They're upset about Governor DeWine's restrictions, and Republicans worked on a bill to override the governor's orders on limiting county fair activities. What about that bill, and is that all there is in it, Anna Staver, do you know?
So this one also sets up a commission that's got, I think it's like 18 to 25 people, depending. So it's a big commission to come up with rules for hosting county fairs next year. They took a lot of testimony sort of saying like, you know, county fairs were initially told you could do it, but you have to come up with COVID restrictions. So they did that. And then they were told, well, it's just going to be a junior fair. So no food vendors, no rides, nothing outside of like 4-H and like the animal shows that they do. And so there was a lot of angry county fair people and who came in and said, look, we just need consistency. Like we need a set of rules to operate under because our boards don't want to put in the work. They don't want to plan for a fair in June, which we have to do now if we don't know what that's going to look like. And I suspect on this one that DeWine might just let this go. He might not veto this bill because I think like the hope, right, is that we'll have a lot of vaccinations before June, July, and August, and that we'll be moving towards a place where maybe we can have a more expanded county fair. And this board that they amended into the bill has Ohio Department of Health workers on it. And I guess for me, I think like this might be a place where he says, okay, let's set up this board. Let's come up with some rules. Let's develop like a way to have a safe fair and let's move forward with the goal of doing that next summer. Because if there's a second spike, if something goes horribly wrong in 2021, and I hate to even put that out there into the world, but if they need to, he can always issue another health order closing the fairs or restricting them to just junior fair and 4-H.
Okay. And they were not able to get through any restrictions on his power to do so.
Correct.
Yeah.
This just removes the order.
There's a couple bills. Well, Governor DeWine did sign into law the Fetal Remains Bill, which requires women who get abortions decide either they're going to have the fetal remains cremated or have a burial. This is goes without saying that the pro-choice community supports this. It has been seen as obviously something that the community opposed to legal abortions supports because it creates yet another sort of obstacle, I guess in this case, kind of an emotional obstacle. But I wanted to, you know, talk about Representative Erica Crawley. She's a Democrat from Columbus. She called her Republican colleagues hypocrites for not also passing legislation dealing with infant and maternal death rates. What's the issue with that bill? It is a huge problem, obviously, especially in Columbus. But Columbus is, you know, the most populous city in the state. What are their objections to that?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what held up that particular piece of legislation, and anyone is welcome to jump in. I know it's something that has gotten bipartisan support in the past, like notably Republican Senator Shannon Jones from the Southwest Ohio area worked very hard on that with her Democratic colleague, Shirley H. DeVarez, worked pretty hard on it as well. So I don't know why that got held up, but it does speak to the larger question of like, what does it mean to be a pro-life legislator, which is always up for debate? Like, is it simply focused on abortion, or are you working on like sex education classes as well? Does it extend to the death penalty? Does it extend to, you know, firearm restrictions? And so that kind of term pro-life lawmaker has really been bandied about quite a bit. And depending on who you talk to, it is quite broad or quite narrow.
Hmm. Anna, what do you think?
Infant mortality, like that bill also reminds me a bit of rural broadband, which also failed to get out of the legislature. These issues that seem to have wide bipartisan support, right? From like rural lawmakers and urban lawmakers and people from all, like, and yet they never get across the finish line. And it's probably one of the most perplexing things about covering the legislature when you're just like, but everybody likes this. Everybody says this is a good idea. And I mean, last year, I think some of it was just a lot of good ideas got sidetracked by the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that probably would have passed if like everything from like sports betting to maternal mortality to broadband, like you look at all these good ideas that enjoyed support that just didn't make it across the finish line. And I don't know that there's like a really good explanation for it, or at least one I've been able to find.
Jeremy, do you think this might be the year? We've been talking about maternal and child and infant mortality rates in Ohio for years now, how bad it is.
I think there might be some second tier bills. I don't think there's any indication so far. It's really at the top of the priority list for incoming legislative leaders. That's not to say there might not be something, but I don't see it being any more of a priority in the 134th General Assembly than it was the past 2 years on the 133rd.
Hmm. Anything else? I mean, what are you guys looking forward to for this coming session, Jeremy Pelzer?
I think school funding reform, is going to be up there. Matt Huffman's going to bring a very different approach to that than Senator Abhoff as Senate president. Obviously, Bob Kupp has been pushing for this for years, and now that he's House Speaker, that he's going to, you know, try again. So I think I anticipate That'll be a big issue. Of course, I don't have to tell you, Anne, that Ohio's school funding system has been ruled unconstitutional for more than 20 years, and lawmakers so far haven't done anything really major to fix it. And
it's
so
actually, well, the ruling came, the ruling came more than 20 years ago. The lawsuit was filed almost 30 years ago. Yeah,
exactly. So I think that'll be a big priority. I think, of course, the big one's going to be the state budget. And there's going to be a lot of unanswered questions with that, especially with state finances and tax revenues. They seem to be recovering, but you know, they're going to make a lot more difficult decisions than they anticipated they would at this time last year.
And Jesse?
Something I read about recently was there was a push right after a householder was arrested and others were arrested to do something about campaign finance transparency, to maybe say where these ads are coming from, as opposed to like Happiness and Rainbows committee pack, you know? And there was a real kind of bipartisan push from Gail Manning, a Republican, and Jessica Miranda, a Democrat. And they are interested in reintroducing that. This is always just a really tough nut to crack because the system benefits the people in it. So I'm intrigued to see if there's going to be any change to that in the new year.
Well, the push won't go away because it's coming from outside the Ohio General Assembly. But what do you think, Anna Staver?
As far as campaign finance reform, or just general?
Just in general, yeah.
So I love tax policy, which is kind of a nerdy thing to really enjoy. But one of the things that has been happening over the last several budgets is they've been cutting the number of tax brackets that Ohio has. We went from like 9 to 7 to 5. And I think the low-hanging fruit is now gone. And if they want, you know, Republicans are always pushing for flat tax. Like they're always pushing for everyone pays the same percentage of their income. But the easy, like getting rid of the lowest income brackets is done. So I'm going to be really curious to see if they try to mangle with that now that it's going to be more difficult, or if they're going to like let it go as is for now. The other thing I'm really curious about is this, the commuter tax that we all pay because we're all still working from home, and whether they actually make a move on it or not. Like the idea is, I'm hearing some rumblings that there is a couple of folks who are planning to try to get a refund from the Columbus and may end up in lawsuit over it. So we could be end up hearing about it even if the legislature doesn't move.
Do you think that's going to go into a class action kind of a mode?
I think it could. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. From everybody I've talked to, I think we are in weird constitutional ground where you're taxing somebody because their building is in Columbus, but they're not working there.
Right. And likewise, it's going to be interesting going forward, because I'm with you on the nerdy stuff as far as how many companies are going to start to alleviate their on-site workforces and what kind of impact that's going to have on the communities of the world that depend on those big employers, like, you know, Worthington.
Oh, absolutely.
The insurance
even my
companies.
Own employers talking about what that might look like.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting. Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. So I'm going to say thanks to all of you and Happy New Year. Welcome back. It's going to be fun. I look forward to maybe having you back in the studio someday soon. But for now, we're distanced and we're alive. So, yay us. Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, Ann.
And Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks as always. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, always a good time.
And Anna Staver, state house reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks a lot for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Happy New Year to everybody. Thanks for listening. I just want to let you know that you can like All Sides on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.